right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program associate here with GTI. Today, I'm so thrilled to be joined by Margaret Myers, the director of the Asia and Latin America program at the Inter-American Dialogue. At the Dialogue, she conducts really important and interesting research relating to the intersection between East Asia and Latin America, with a particular focus on economics and trade dynamics. Previously, she helped develop the China-Latin America Finance Database, which is really one of the only databases compiling data on Chinese state-led investment in Latin America. She's also held positions in the Department of Defense, as well as academic positions at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and Johns Hopkins SAIS. She is the co-editor of two volumes on Trans-Pacific Economic Interactions, and her other writings and opinion pieces have been featured around the world. Margaret, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Marshall. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, again, I'm so glad to have you here at what really seems to be a pivotal time for Taiwan's relationship with Central America. For decades, the region really served as one of Taipei's last bastions of international support in the international community, with several of Taiwan's formal diplomatic allies located there. However, developments over the last 4 to 5 years have really called this dynamic into question. In 2017, Panama severed its ties with Taiwan, switching them over to the People's Republic of China, with El Salvador following suit a year later. Now, following Nicaragua's decision to switch recognition in December of last year, Taiwan is left to a mere three allies in the region, which are Honduras, Guatemala, and Belize. So despite Taipei's best efforts to maintain this shrinking foothold in the region, it's thus far proven unable to compete with China's promises of lavish investment programs, political support. So with all this in mind, in this really pivotal time, Margaret, I'm so glad to have you here to share your perspectives on the past, present, and future of Taiwan's really complicated relationship with Central America. So to start off, I'd love to just get an overview of kind of the state of play in Central America, you know, the balance of power between Taiwan and China, and how stable is Taiwan's current position in the region? And building on that, so what sort of tactics is Beijing employing to really erode this position even further?
Yeah, I mean, so as you noted, this really is a very precarious moment for Taiwan, in part because we've seen a lot of movement in just the past, you know, 2-3 years in terms of, you know, Central American countries in particular establishing formal diplomatic ties with Beijing. And, you know, the loss of Panama in particular, which was, you know, the largest economy in the Latin American and Caribbean region to maintain ties with Taiwan for a number of years was, I think, a particularly big blow to Taiwan, followed, of course, by El Salvador, which for the U.S. was a bit alarming, given that the U.S. has maintained for many years, you know, very strong strategic and security-related ties, security-related cooperation with El Salvador. So that prompted a couple of years ago, very strong reaction from the U.S. government, from the Trump administration in particular, and from a number of folks on the Hill. And the Dominican Republic, too. You know, we've seen, this switch, which also came as something of a surprise, I think, to those of us who observe the relationship. And then most recently, I mean, a lot of folks have had their eyes on Honduras, right? Given the new president's indications, you know, at least amid her campaign, that she might be considering establishing formal ties to the People's Republic. But and so in doing so, you know, in sort of maintaining this focus on Honduras, I think a lot were caught off guard by this decision by Nicaragua, right, in particular, to cut ties just a few weeks ago. See, I don't know if we would call it a domino effect or not, right? The Nicaragua decision, was years, you know, followed years after some of these other decisions. And it strikes me that, you know, Honduras is still very much weighing its options, right? There were indications that it was, you know, thinking about changing its status, and that was walked back somewhat, at least, you know, in official statements and in sort of unofficial commentary about relations with China and Taiwan. Paraguay is, of course, you know, another really critical ally for Taiwan. That's in South America and not in Central America. But there does seem to be continuous support for a strong relationship with Taiwan. despite some efforts on the part of interest groups within the country to push for formalized ties with China because of, you know, the importance of soy trade and other forms of trade with China and the expectation that a formal diplomatic relationship with China would provide opportunities for growth in that trade. But there, I mean, the government in that is currently in power is, you know, very supportive of this relationship, even to the extent of, you know, making some of China's demands and overtures public, right, especially as concerns its vaccine diplomacy outreach. At the onset of the pandemic and as China was looking to deliver vaccines to the region, it suggested to Paraguay that the one way in which Paraguay could receive Chinese vaccines was indeed to cut ties with Taiwan. And the Paraguayan government made that statement public to media sources. And so that's an indication, at least in my view, that there is still a very strong interest in maintaining, you know, these political ties to Taiwan. So, I mean, it really depends on the country that we're talking about. I think there are different views in different countries. There are different interest groups in different countries pushing different objectives related to either relations with Taiwan or with China. But this is, I mean, as you noted, a difficult moment for Taiwan. There has been a loss of several really important allies. What I will say, though, you know, Marshall, and I'll end with this so that we can get to the next question, is that when countries cut ties with Taiwan, the outcomes really range quite considerably, right? And in some cases, you know, there are a number of deals that are struck with China, wide-ranging deals, some of them quite large. Panama is an excellent example of that. But in other cases, you know, the interactions are really limited and the deal-making is really pretty limited as well. You know, you have a few sort of maybe public works projects that are pursued, perhaps some memorandums of understanding, some educational cooperation agreements, things of that nature. But in many cases, I mean, I would say at least thus far, you know, and there could be more deal making in the future with China. But thus far, some of it, you know, doesn't necessarily exceed what Taiwan would have given these countries in the first place, you know, in terms of development assistance. So it really is quite critical to understand the extent to which, you know, this decision to cut ties with Taiwan and establish them with China will indeed be of benefit, broadly speaking, and in the longer term and sustainably, right, for the countries in question.
I'm glad you brought up Nicaragua. It's such an interesting case. I feel like we saw the other ones coming. Like you said, it was, you know, the Nicaragua case seemed to really come out of nowhere because everybody was focusing on Honduras. So I'm interested to hear, you know, they just last month declared that, and I quote, the People's Republic of China is the only legitimate government that represents all of China and Taiwan, is an inalienable part of the Chinese territory, which really towing the party line. So I'd be interested, you know, you mentioned that this isn't purely financial, that there's always other factors at play. So I'd be interested, do you have a sense of what motivated this decision to switch and at this time? And was it purely a financial decision or were there other domestic factors at play?
So what I think is interesting about the Nicaragua decision in particular is the timing of the decision. Because Nicaragua and China have had really strong, you know, ties, if not formal diplomatic ties for a number of years now. They have, in many cases, supported each other's political agendas. For example, Nicaragua supported China's Hong Kong security law, right, in within the United Nations during a vote, and has done so in other international organizations as well. And certainly China has, you know, been supportive, broadly speaking, at least not critical of what's happening in the political realm in Nicaragua. So why did this happen at this particular juncture and not earlier? And also, I should mention, you know, there was, of course, that for a number of years ago, around 2015, a major venture between a Chinese entrepreneur, Wang Jing, and the government of Nicaragua to pursue, of course, the Nicaragua Canal, which was a very sizable proposed project at the time and has since fallen by the wayside. But right now, you know, I think there are a couple of reasons that both China and Nicaragua were interested in, you know, in pursuing formal diplomatic ties. On the Nicaraguan side, you know, the government there, the president has pursued an agenda that has for many years, but especially now, you know, sought to erode critical democratic institutions and very much resembles a authoritarianism, and as a result, you know, has drawn considerable criticism from the United States, from other democratic nations, and, you know, also not, if not criticism, has not been supported as extensively as it might need to be by international financial institutions, including, for example, the Inter-American Development Bank and others. And so also because of various economic and financial decisions that are being made there. So, you know, there is a real lack of finance and a need to pursue new sources of finance. And for this reason, Nicaragua has turned to other countries. Russia is one, right? China is another, for sources of support for an agenda that the Nicaraguan president has laid out and intends to pursue over the next year and more. So China, is indeed a critical source of support. And to be clear, Nicaragua did turn to Taiwan for some assistance, for some finance in support of this agenda. But Taiwan, as I understand it, turned that down because of the nature of what is happening on the ground in Nicaragua and the sorts of things that the president is intending to support or pursue. Then on the Chinese side, you know, this, I think it was a long time coming. Obviously, there are interests in ensuring that all of Taiwan's allies cut ties with Taiwan and establish them, with the PRC. But in addition to that, the decision happened to be made during the sort of U.S.-sponsored democracy summit. So I think in many ways, you know, was coincidental, but also a very symbolic gesture. Although, you know, there's been some criticism of the Democratic Summit itself, right, and the way it was carried out internationally. It did elicit a pretty strong response in China. It was really quite irksome, I'll say, to China. China issued its own white paper, sort of advocating China's approach to democratic governance, and published similar op-eds across the entire Latin American and Caribbean region and also other parts of the world. It published many, many commentaries sort of critical of Democracy Summit itself. And so it strikes me that it's not out of the question, right, that perhaps the timing of this was somewhat related to the timing of the Democracy Summit. But also, of course, cross-state tensions were as they are in all of these cases, the primary motivating factor, in my view.
Sure. Well, thank you for that. I'd like to actually just look a little bit north. You know, we mentioned that we were all a little bit distracted by Honduras when the Nicaragua announcement was made. But I'd like to talk a little bit about Honduras because it is really, you know, really the most focused one right now. Despite a long history of Taiwanese investment in the country, it increasingly seems like the relationship between Taiwan and Honduras is on shaky ground. Xiomara Castro, the recently elected Honduran president, as you mentioned earlier, campaigned on establishing formal ties with the People's Republic. But again, as you brought up earlier, she's been a little bit silent on the issue, has pulled back on it slightly since her inauguration. I'd be interested to hear what you think. You know, how concerned, if you're a Taiwanese leader, should you be about the future of its alliance with Honduras? And building on that, is there anything extra that Taiwan can do to bolster its relationship? Or is this, you know, a larger geopolitical issue that's out of Taipei's hands?
This is a very difficult calculation, and obviously one that Taiwan is considering very, very seriously. The U.S. too, for that matter. I wouldn't say that it's outside of Taiwan's hands. It's just that, you know, Latin American countries, including some countries with, you know, diplomatic ties to Taiwan, continue to view China, whether they should or not, right, as a sort of answer to their development woes. And this is especially the case now that many countries in the region have faced extensive economic challenges, also social unrest, social upheaval that's likely to continue in the coming months and years, you know, as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so, you know, they see China as something of a solution or at least a critical partner in all of this. As I said, that doesn't always turn out to be the case, right? It's not as though China, you know, is necessarily a savior to a lot of these Central American countries or even Caribbean countries, right? Which some of which are allies for Taiwan, once they decide to, you know, cut ties with Taiwan, does China in fact come to the rescue or not? Do Chinese investments have a strong impact on overall economic growth or on the well-being of individual communities or the population as a whole? These are sort of questions that have yet to be answered. And, you know, really the outcomes vary considerably on a case-by-case basis, as I mentioned. But what I think does need to happen, right, is there needs to be a very clear indication on the part of Taiwanese actors that, first of all, you know, what Taiwan is proposing in the way of assistance aligns well with the needs of these countries. And that is has been the case. You know, when you look at the sorts of development projects that Taiwan has put forth, they very much align with especially sort of soft developmental challenges in the educational space, in the health space, in terms of agricultural development and so on. But a lot of these countries and a lot of these leaders are looking for, you know, larger scale infrastructure investment and other projects that will be potentially of greater political benefit to them and delivered within a certain, you know, sort of electoral time frame. That's not something that a lot of countries can do. China does make that happen, right? But there are potentially opportunities for the U.S. and Taiwan and other like-minded, you know, countries and their, you know, development cooperation agencies or aid agencies to work together to leverage each other's resources in support of infrastructure development or other projects that will indeed be, you know, able to be delivered within a certain time frame, but also very clearly supportive, not only of development agendas, but also of, you know, the interests of specific leaders at given time. Obviously, these interests, any interests that are supported need to be, you know, well validated and broadly supported by other stakeholders. But, you know, this is, I think, cooperation, collaboration among wide-ranging actors, including European ones. I mentioned, you know, Japan and Taiwan, but will be absolutely fundamental if Taiwan is to compete more effectively with China in the region, and frankly, if the U.S. is to compete more effectively with China in the region, because indeed, in some sectors, China is exceedingly competitive, regardless of who we're talking about, as a sort of alternative, you know, investor.
Sure. I think that's a great transition, a great segue into my next question, which, as you mentioned, there are outside actors that have an interest in this and have an influence in this. And among them, the United States is probably the most significant. And as you mentioned earlier, this is an area of the world that has traditionally been seen as kind of the U.S. sphere of influence. And it's been interesting watching these countries, these developing countries, increasingly turn to the People's Republic for, you know, development aid, infrastructure investment. I'd be interested to hear, you mentioned that the U.S. has been critical of past decisions to switch recognition, you know, in the case of El Salvador and Nicaragua. I'd be interested, what role does the U.S. play in influencing these countries' decision-making, you know, vis-a-vis China and Taiwan? And what, if anything, can Washington do, looking down at Central America, to prevent nations like Honduras from defecting to the PRC in the future?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, when El Salvador cut ties in particular, right, there was a very, very strong response. And then, you know, also to sort of retroactively to the Panamanian decision, and that a lot of that sort of, you know, very strong rhetoric and even in some cases threats to withdraw, you know, development assistance and other forms of assistance was a feature of some of the commentary that was made at that particular time. We are not seeing that same approach, you know, that same very strong rhetoric, condemning rhetoric and threatening rhetoric, right, from the Biden administration. It's been much quieter on this decision by Nicaragua, understanding that these are, you know, decisions that governments are, you know, are allowed to take. It's their sovereign right to make these decisions and to determine how to align themselves diplomatically. But what the U.S. can do, I think, and what I think is happening are sort of quieter discussions, right, with those countries that maintain ties with Taiwan, demonstrating the value of doing so, you know, demonstrating that the U.S. supports, you know, Taiwan's continued engagement with the region, that it is aligned in many ways, the views on development assistance, views on, you know, strengthening of institutions, of democratic institutions in particular, are something that Taiwan and the U.S. share and can, you know, support each other in doing so in some of these countries. And, you know, talking about, you know, again, the fact that, you know, simply cutting ties with Taiwan and establishing them with China doesn't necessarily mean that your country is going to turn around economically, right? Or that this will be a sort of saving, a savior type situation, right? So, I think from a messaging perspective, there are a number of different approaches that the U.S. can take. And then, as I mentioned, on the other hand, you know, it's more than just talk. The U.S. And Taiwan, for that matter, and, you know, anyone else, any other countries that would be looking to collaborate in this way do need to propose, and I think are thinking critically about how to do so, right? Certain investment projects in these countries that are indeed sustainable, that will be carried out according to a certain, you know, already established time frame, that will involve some degree of technology transfer, that are, you know, environmentally sound, that, you know, employ, you know, labor rights, that employ locals, that, you know, really are of tremendous mutual benefit, to borrow a term from, you know, from China and its own policy. And to make it clear, right, that these projects are on the way, and that maintaining ties to Taiwan can indeed be of not just short term, you know, benefit, but of longer term benefit from a development perspective. And in addition to that, you know, it's interesting. I'm curious about, you know, just how much interest. I don't think anyone wants to be the last man standing, so to speak, right? But those that are, you know, still allied with Taiwan at this particular juncture do enjoy something of a privileged status, right? Paraguay, you know, Honduras, Belize. I mean, these countries are, and certain countries in the Caribbean, right? These countries have even more focus on them now than they did in the past, and may very well enjoy even more support from Taiwan and a more privileged relationship than they had. So, you know, hopefully they'll be able to work, you know, extensively with Taiwan to identify what indeed are their development challenges and ways in which Taiwan can support those, whether with, you know, backing from the U.S. or from other like-minded nations.
Well, Margaret, again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm so glad to have you here right now. I think it is such a crucial juncture for Taiwan's relationships with the region, specifically with Honduras. Just last week, Taiwan Vice President Lai Ching-te visited Honduras to attend the inauguration of President Castro, where he met with several high-level Honduran officials. And notably, the trip was followed fairly closely by an announcement from Honduras's new foreign minister that Honduras would maintain ties with Taiwan for the foreseeable future. So, in your perspective, could you talk a little bit about how this visit unfolded, and do you view this as a successful visit for Taiwan?
Yes, I mean, I couldn't agree more with your assessment, Marshall. This was an absolutely critical moment, right, for Taiwan to engage, and to engage through, you know, through Vice President Lai, a very high-ranking government official. And so, in doing so, sort of at the onset of this presidency, they have, I think, very successfully secured, at least for the time being, you know, a commitment to continue diplomatic relations with Taiwan. And they've done so. I mean, certainly, you know, the vice president underscored a few, I think, personal points that perhaps resonated with the president, congratulating her on being the first female president of Honduras. And of course, you know, Taiwan also has a female president, but also, you know, made some promises, delivered some COVID-19 support in the way of supplies, COVID-19 related supplies, but also reinforced Taiwan's commitment to agriculture, education, medical services, and to, you know, finding more opportunities to increase trade. And these have been sort of the fundamental features of Taiwanese outreach in Central America and indeed other parts of the world for many years now. And so, you know, underscored these commitments to some of the, you know, very critical development objectives that Honduras faces.
Great. I'm glad you mentioned, you know, looking to the future, because that's what I'd like to do now. And if you don't mind, I'd like to look a little bit forward about Taiwan's position in Central America. And I kind of have a two-part question. We've been so interested here at the Global Taiwan Institute in looking at Taiwan's remaining diplomatic allies. And there's been a bit of a debate over the value of these allies. And, you know, is it worth it for Taiwan to maintain its current levels of investment in these allies? Is it engaging in checkbook diplomacy? in your opinion, looking at these relationships with these Central American countries, is it worth it for Taiwan to continue or even expand its current levels of investment in these, you know, last remaining allies in Central Latin America? Or on the other side, you know, we've also seen in recent days, in recent months, you know, Taiwan building more informal relationships with countries around the world, whether it's Lithuania, increasingly now with Slovenia. Are there opportunities for Taiwan to, you know, even with countries that are no longer partners, that are no longer allies, are there opportunities for Taiwan to build informal relationships? Or is, you know, Beijing's presence in the region just too strong?
You know, I don't know that they're mutually exclusive. I think that Taiwan ought to, you know, pursue a sort of two-pronged strategy. But I will say that, you know, at least in the case of Guyana, right, most recently, which was looking to establish a commercial office of Taiwan, which is a standard practice, right, they decided on their own not to do so, you know, just after it was opened, they decided to close it down because, you know, there was a sense that by you know, publicizing this decision and opening, you know, and strengthening ties with Taiwan at this particular juncture, that they would risk access to vaccines from China, which, you know, in the end turned out to be not as effective as many had thought. But, you know, nevertheless, you know, the strategic calculation was that this was too risky of a decision. And I think we'll continue to see, you know, decisions made to avoid stronger, you know, ties with Taiwan, even if not formal diplomatic ones, right? Because of not necessarily direct pressure from Beijing, but even just sort of indirect pressure, given the extent of Chinese economic influence in the region and just how dependent some of these countries are on infusions of capital from China and on trade with China. And so it's not going to be an easy thing to do. That said, I think, you know, both strategies have value, are worthwhile. And I do think, you know, there are at least a handful of you know, allies out there that are still committed, at least, you know, in their current political state to, you know, to continuing to maintain a strong relationship with Taiwan.
Well, Margaret, I think that's a great way to end. And just sort of, it's going to be an interesting future for Taiwan's relationship with Central America. And I think you've made it clear, this is a really interesting time. It's a critical time for Taiwan's relationship with the region. But just looking to the future, I think it's going to be really fascinating. And, you know, we're worried, but excited. So thank you so much for providing so much crucial context to these relationships. So thank you again.
My pleasure, Marshall. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you also to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief, as well as our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts, as well as on our website's podcast page. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.